the talk tonight, I asked if anyone had any suggestions as to what I should talk about. And the suggestions we had were generosity, the limits of vinaya, and death. So, putting that all together, be generous because vinaya has limits and you're going to die. Okay? And I think that's a fairly good guide to life. Could do worse. Seriously though, death does have its lighter moments. And hopefully we'll all get to experience those things sooner or later. And they should do a PR campaign or something for death. You know, death is a natural part of life. You know, they used to advertise sugar, but that was that sugar is a natural part of life. So then that would be a nice advertising campaign. Death, a natural part of life. Or another one could be, you could use take a thing from Coke. You say death, the real thing. Yeah. Oh, what a feeling. When we did the interfaith talk the other night, and the Christian minister David Millikan made a kind of curious argument. He said that, talking about the times of death, and he said if you've read the accounts of the death of Socrates, which you should all read, and if you haven't read, you should feel guilty. And go downstairs, find a copy and read it, because it really is very extraordinary piece of writing and piece of literature. But the account of Socrates' death shows a man who was very much they usually say rational, but very kind of reasonable and balanced right up to the time of his death, and no matter what happened. Of course, he had to tell the women to go away because they were weeping and moaning and stuff. So he had to get them out of the way so he could have a nice calm death. And sat there, or lay down there and drank, sat with his friends, drank the hemlock, lay down and died. And even though his friends wanted to kind of spring him from the jail, he wouldn't let them. He just said, I've been condemned by the court for corrupting the youth, and so this is what I'll go to my death for. And he went to his death very serenely, with a great deal of acceptance. And David Millikan contrasted this with the death of Jesus, where he was so traumatized that in one of the accounts it said that night before his crucifixion he was sweating blood. That's how stressed he was about the whole thing. And as we know, according to one of the gospel accounts on the cross, he cried out, "Oh, my God, why have you forsaken me?" So Dave Millikan's argument was that the reason why there was such a difference between the two was because Socrates believed in an immortal soul. So he believed that after his body was laid down, his soul would live on forever. According to the kind of Socratic or Platonic line of reasoning, the soul is the inference or the understanding of what the soul is through a kind of a process of abstraction or reasoning, which is always moving towards the good, the pure, the true, the virtuous, the beautiful, and at the sort of the peak of that for each individual is something like what Plato or Socrates would regard as the soul. And so if the soul is something which is pure and good and eternal, because what's changeable is not good, then surely the experience after death must be pleasant. Whereas Jesus had no such solace, again according to David Millikan's argument, because he didn't believe in an eternal soul. This is a very problematic proposition. At the very least, it's unclear really what Jesus' actual beliefs were, but this is why he was in so much doubt before his death. But I find a number of difficulties, a number of problems with this particular argument, and one problem is that Socrates didn't, when if you look more closely at what Socrates said, if I remember rightly, what he said was, if I have an eternal soul, then I'm going to be happy because the soul is pure. If I don't have an eternal soul, then I'm not going to have any experience, and so there's nothing to be afraid of. Something like that. So it's like a conditional argument, an argument based on a particular set of beliefs, but a conditional argument. And similarly with Jesus, it's not really certain what his beliefs were. I'm somewhat dubious about whether one's, to what extent one's beliefs are going to actually help you in the time of death. And I don't really think that the difference between Jesus and Socrates was a matter of their beliefs, but much more a matter of their personalities. And Socrates was very consistently a very even-headed, reasonable, calm person. Jesus' personality is much more not so easy to discern, since the accounts are not particularly consistent, but he seems to have been much more volatile and emotional as a person. And the other thing, a great point of comparison, of course, is the life of the Buddha, where he too met his death with serenity, with peace, and with acceptance. And that wasn't, that had nothing to do with the belief in an eternal soul, of course. But again, the death of the Buddha is very much in tune simply with how he was all the time. His death wasn't anything different than his life. He behaved, greeted his time of death the same way that he greeted everything in his life. With wisdom, with compassion, with acceptance. So if we look at different Buddhist teachings on death and how we can greet it with that kind of attitude, we find that most of the time what the Buddha recommends or says is going to be useful for us at that time is practices and things which we can do rather than our attitudes or emotions or something that we can develop rather than a set of beliefs which we can adopt. It's again not to say that beliefs are irrelevant, but just simply to say that they are only one factor in the equation. And very often the Buddha would say, for example, if we develop mindfulness, and if we are mindful all the time, then we won't be confused at the time of death. Similarly, if we develop breath meditation, that if you really develop anapanasati very deeply, then even your last breaths will be known to you, not unknown. So that would be quite beautiful, wouldn't it? Yeah, to be able to go to one's death with that degree of mindfulness and composure, so that just even the last breaths were known to you. Okay, this is it. And then go. That's a real mindfulness. Again, metta meditation was said to lead to dying in a state that's unconfused. So of course none of these things have anything to do with one's beliefs about an afterlife or not having an afterlife. And similarly, the other reflection, of course, is the reflection of death itself. And when one reflects on that, as taught in the Satipatthana Sutta and many other places, it's simply a reflection and a meditation, a contemplation and internalization of the banal facts that we're all going to die and there's nothing we can do about it. And this is perhaps the most trivial and everyday of facts that we know so well that we don't even bother to say it or to spell it out. And its very ordinariness and its absoluteness as a truth means it becomes taboo. So things which are taboo are very often not things which are esoteric and hidden and secret, but those things which are right out there in public. The unsayable. So this is why we find so many euphemisms. And, you know, we all have had a good laugh at the dead parrot sketch. Yeah? He's gone to meet his maker, he's joined the bleeding choir invisible, he's pushing up the daisies, he's all these things. And so the underlying logic of that sketch is simply the fact that we use so many words to avoid saying he's dead. That's why there's so many idioms in the English language and other languages for that thing. We're trying to avoid the topic. So one day this is all going to stop. And we have to be ready to accept that. Now, as long as it doesn't happen before the cave is finished, then I'm happy to. So it may happen that we reach a ripe old age and we're lying there in bed thinking, oh, well, we've done so many good things with our life, completed all the things we wanted to do, and we feel happy and content and ready to either move on or reach a cessation if such is our level of development. And so that may be the case, or of course it may not be. And so many people, their deaths don't happen like that. One time we went to visit a monk called Lumpo Jun, who was a senior disciple of Ajahn Chah, and he was dying of cancer. And we went to see him at Wat Bapong. And he was only a few weeks away from his death at that time, and he just laughed at us all and said, oh, you might die before I do. What are you coming here for? You might all die today. So we never really know the time, do we? Would you want to know the time? Would that help? So if you look at the practices which the Buddha talked about regarding death, you see, the result of those things is not, or should not be, a kind of weirdness and morbidity. But the result of them is life. If we do breath meditation, the Buddha said you should practice so that you know each breath. That might be your last. Each in breath, you might not breathe out. Each out breath, you might not breathe in. So you contemplate each breath and knowing that each breath is so precious, it might be your last. What happens if it is? What if it really is your last? Is that okay? Well, the contemplation of death itself yeah, it might seem like a morbid contemplation. What do you do? Sit watching, imagining skulls and corpses and rotting and all of these kinds of grisly things. But then you look at what is the effect of that supposed to be. And it says what the outcome of that is supposed to give an arousal of energy. Yeah? So death is a state where energy dissipates from our body. But by contemplating it, gives rise to a sense of urgency. They call samvega. So if you go to any of the Thai forest ajahns and ask them, say, listen, I feel unmotivated, uninspired, don't have the enthusiasm for practice that I would like, then they'll immediately tell you, contemplate death. Do it all the time. Do it in your meditation, do it outside of your meditation. Watch the leaves in the forest decaying. Look at the young trees and the old trees. Look at the dead wood lying on the floor of the forest. Everything that you do, watch for that sign of decay and the sign of death. And we have to internalize this reality, this inevitability of death. The more we can do that, the better we can live. So one of the reflections that's given for samanas, for those who've gone forth, is to reflect each day. The days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? It's a very beautiful thing to contemplate. And the days and nights just keep going by. What am I doing with my life? How am I actually spending my time? And one of the things which the Buddha reminded us again and again and again is that we cannot keep that which we have in this life. And I think if I was trying to remember the phrasing that's used in these very beautiful reflections of the Dhamma or summaries of the Dhamma which are found in the Ratthapala Sutta, and Ratthapala says, I think it's there's nothing, asako I think is the word, there's nothing of one's own. The world has nothing of one's own. One has to leave all and pass on. So we don't own anything. So we think about this idea of not self. You know, and sometimes I get a little bit frustrated when people try to take not self as a very kind of abstract philosophical idea that doesn't have very much actual impact. But one of the important aspects of not self is we don't own anything. You have to leave everything behind and pass on. So just all the possessions we have, we surround ourselves with physical things, bahidha rupa, external physical form, you know? And those external physical form are things which help to define us, to identify us, yeah? Our clothes, the possessions, the things that we like or don't like, yeah? Do we have a Mac or a PC? Yeah, that tells us who we are. What colour? How do we do our hair? What kind of clothes do we wear? All of these things, these are things which we're using to create an identity. it's very hard. It's interesting in monastic life where we try to minimize these things as much as possible, and still you can't quite get beyond it, and you find that there's some monks who like robes of a certain color, and then some, have more kind of like nice refined robes, and some have more kind of rough coarse robes, and some have lighter color or darker color, and all these kind of tiny little details, but there's still some kind of expression of self, some kind of externalization of identity in one's possessions, investment. We invest ourselves in these things. But that all has to be left. As kotis, the dwellings, books, anything we have has to be left and then passed on. And of course, if you don't leave it behind, then there's all the cautionary tales about the monk who got reborn as a bug in his robes. He was so attached to his set of robes that he got reborn as a bug in living in the robes. And these kinds of things. So you have to be careful not to be attached. But as well as being tales of karma, but those stories are also reminders of how completely absurd all of these things are. Yeah? You think the robes is, it's just some kind of cotton which was, grown somewhere in a patch of land, I've got no idea where, and, woven together somewhere, sewn up and dyed and shipped. It's completely impersonal, it's actually got nothing to do with me. Just happens to be this robe out of so many thousands of others was given to me at some stage, and so I wear it around. That's all there is to it. And yet somehow you think of it as mine. It's me. So one of the things I always remember that Giles telling us about was that one of the signs of somebody is suicidal, or potentially suicidal, one of the signs that you tell is that they give their things away. If you see somebody who's suffering from depression or is alone or something like that, and then they start giving their gifts to people. Oh, here's my special book that I have. Yeah, here's this lovely Buddha Rupa which I got from Nepal. Here's this piece of cloth, and so on. Then that's a sign that they're giving everything away, they're giving everything up, they're getting ready. They want to make sure. See, in that case, it's not really a lack of ownership, but it's really that they still want their possessions to be looked after they're gone. And trying to ensure that continuation of themselves, like a piece of themselves, is still carried on and kept among their friends to remind them. Imagine how that would feel, for the person who received that gift. Yeah? Somebody gives you a book of poetry. They say, oh, look, here's this book, I thought you might like it. And then a few days later they kill themselves. How would you feel seeing that book on your bookshelf after that? That would always remind you of them. It's always a part of them. So in that case, that's a kind of a twisted giving, it's a wrong giving, because it's not a letting go of self, but it's a continuation and attachment to self. So this is one of the qualities which we're not supposed to cultivate in giving, and that's the Pali word apatiwana citto, is a mind which doesn't think of getting anything back. That's the mind, the true mind of giving. And so that true mind of giving should be just to really let go of everything. Giving, just really give, to really give it up. Apatiwana citto. There's nothing good. which we own in this world. We have to leave everything and pass on. And so once we know that, then we can learn to live much more lightly in the world, to not have many things, not have many possessions. I noticed this when I was at my mum and stepfather once, and they were packing for some journey or something like that, and my stepdad said, never hurts to put in an extra pair of trousers, because you never know when you might need it. And so this is the thing of maybe you'll need it. So that really kind of struck me how different it was to the way that I think when I'm packing things and I'm going on a journey, I always think, well, maybe I won't need it. So you can ask yourself these things. Maybe you don't need it. What would happen without it? Is that necessary? And so when we think, not to think, oh, maybe it'll come in useful. Kind of the mind of a hoarder. Oh, it'll come in useful one day. And so you end up with your life cluttered up with all kinds of useless junk that in fact didn't come in useful one day. And even if it does come in useful one day, then you can always find something else, some other way around it, some other way to do what needs to be done. So if we're always thinking about this, maybe we don't need that. And maybe we could think in terms of giving rather than in terms of getting and holding on. We're going to have to abandon it sooner or later. So might as well get some practice in. Because there's always two attitudes to that. There's the pie shop in Berrima that says, life's short, eat dessert first. another way of putting it, you might die before the main course. So the practice of generosity is in fact very closely linked with this, closely linked with this idea of not being invested in one's materiality, invested in the things of this world. And I think personally I find it always a bit sad when you see people who are rich and hoarders and not people who are generous when they get old and they're coming to their death and they're just still worried about their money, worried about their house, you know, worried about their family going to be squabbling over their riches. There's nothing sadder than that. Yeah. How many families have been broken apart because the children argue about the money? Much better to just get rid of all the money. There's nothing to argue about. So when we're thinking like this, we should always try to see, well, what's the best thing we can do? So if we have these things, have these possessions or whatever, try to think, well, how can we use that in a way that's useful? When we were at Nilmini's house last week, we were having a bit of a discussion. She was saying that a week or two before, the chaser had this segment on dana, on generosity, and there was a local school, one of the two wealthiest boys' schools in Sydney. One of them, I think, is Knox College, and I think this one was the other one. I'm not sure. I can't remember what it's called. Not from Sydney, but there's a very well-known upper-class school, and where all the rich people send their sons, and they needed a new rowing shed. They were doing a fundraising for their rowing shed, so the chaser decided that this was a very worthy cause, so they travelled to Somalia and went round to villages in Somalia doing fundraising for the rowing shed in this college. telling people, oh, it's a 30-year-old shed, it really needs to be replaced, you know, and it's going to be really beneficial for the boys to learn their rowing. And trying to persuade the villagers there to hand over there. Oh, it's terrible, isn't it? But it really puts it in perspective, yeah? And our lifestyle here, in living in the developed world, the first world, and, you know, we think that there's something wrong if the hot water goes cold for one day, and we think, oh, how can that be? It's terrible. There's like probably 5.5 billion people in the world who never have hot water. We never even have clean water coming out of the tap. And just to have hot water out of a tap is an incredible luxury. And no one had that until just recently. It's only in the last, I don't know how long it's been available, but not very long that people have had a widespread availability of hot water coming out of a tap. It's an extraordinary thing. So we shouldn't think of these things as necessities. It's a luxury. It's a convenience, that's all. And I think it's very good for all of us to spend some time living in less developed countries and seeing how people live and how they get by and what you can get by with. And this is one of the greatest lessons I learned from being in Thailand. It's just how little you actually need. And sometimes I'd sit in my kuti, I especially remember my little kuti in Phujongkom, and just sit and look, think how many things are not here. How many things, I could just sit here all day just counting the things that are not here. To count the things that are here would take 5 minutes. It's just me, there's a lower robe, upper robe, sangati, spare change of lower robe, two shoulder cloths, bathing cloth, straw mat, blanket, towel, steel cup, candles, matches. What else? That's about it. Razor blade, thank you. Yeah. Belt, razor blade, thongs. Except I didn't wear thongs a lot of the time. I didn't have a pillow. I used to use my cup as a pillow. That saves you one thing. Bowl, yeah. Didn't I say bowl?
No.
Oh, bowl, anyway, bowl, yeah. Bowl cover. Didn't have a spoon. A table spoon made with my fingers. And, a mosquito net. Umbrella sometimes, yeah. What was it on the pen? You mentioned pen?
I just said spoiled.
Spoiled, yeah. Yeah. Clock. Clock. Anyway, so that's about it. Probably one or two other things, but not that much more. Little bit of rupa in the corner. Anyway, so and that was the happiest I've ever been in my life. I've never felt such freedom, never felt such contentment. It's really all, I had absolutely no interest whatsoever in having anything else. Not the slightest bit interested. So of course this is one of the great secrets of desire and craving, is that the more you have, the more you want. And again, that was another one of the great lessons in the Raktapala Sutta, talking to the king, that it's the more you have, the more you want. The world is insatiable, tanha daso, slave to craving. That's always been one of my favorites. For I had a one idea that I had was reality-based naming system for new ordinands. So one system is the aspirational, but then the other one is the realism-based naming system. So Tanha Daso would be one, you know, slave to craving. That would be with my friend Wirajo, told everyone to call him Mahakileso. One of great defilement. So when we were saying this high monastery, and it was very funny because he said as a joke, oh yeah, you should call me Mahakileso, great, one of the great farmers. And the Thaimites who were there thought it was hilarious. So they hadn't heard anything quite that funny before. So they did it, and they started calling him Mahakileso. But then of course in Thai you abbreviate everything, so it just became Maha. So we all ended up calling him Ajahn Maha, and the lay people picked it up as well, and it was everyone Ajahn Maha. Which is kind of, I didn't realize what Maha was short for. It's usually like Mahabanya or something like that, great wisdom or great defilement. So it was very apt. But so another one, Tanha Daso, or Tanha Dasi, we could use for the seminaries or something. We haven't chosen the seminary ordination name, but another one. So where was I? Oh yeah, slave to craving. The more we have, the more we want, of course, because it's never perfect. And so if you have that mind that by getting things you're going to be happy, then you're never going to be happy and you always want to get more things. So this is one of the great delusions, Mahamoha, in the world, is to think, oh, just that, if I can just have that, then I'll be happy. That's one of the great delusions. If I just that little bit extra, then I'll have that. Yeah? It's just like the spinal tap going up to 11. So it goes up to 10, the amp goes up to 10, but if you can just get it up to 11, it's just that little bit extra, and then it'll be okay, it'll go up to 11. You'll be pleased to know that our new PA system actually goes up to 12. Right? That's that good. Right? So that was, of course, the main reason why I bought it. So we want more. The more we want, the more we have, the more we want. So practicing that mind of letting go, practicing the mind of generosity, the mind of giving. The more we can do that, the more regularly we can do that. It's one of the very, very great things that allow us to reach our death with calmness and with equanimity. Get used to giving everything away, really giving it away. Not thinking about getting it back or how you can control it and keep it going and those kinds of things. Those of you who have been in the monastery for a while, we've seen a few examples of that when people have come along giving things. And then after a while it becomes clear that it's not such a quite a gift after all, but it's more like half me, half monastery, half whatever. Gift is a gift. If we give, we don't think about it again. The thought, me and mine, is not part of that anymore. It's not part of the equation. We just give. It's gone. We have to give up everything. We give up our body. Give our body to science or whatever. Give our mind to the Dhamma. So I guess that's enough for talk for this evening on death and giving. I didn't manage to work in the limitations of vinaya in there. But maybe that can be another talk. I offer this to you for your reflection, and I want to invite any comments or questions or reflections.